Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
As the announcement was made that Richard Linklater's 2014 film Boyhood was among those nominated for this year's Academy Awards, Vice looks back on its interview with the ambitious filmmaker as he discusses the 12-year process of exploring the nuances of youth and the passage of time.
Hey, stop! Put the barrier up!
This movie was always so hard to describe, like the essence of it. But on one level, it's big. It's about life, you know? It's about growing up. It's about time passing and about life going on. And, you know, that sounds so, like, ephemeral, but it's actually pretty specific.
Hi, I'm Raihan Salam. Today, Vice meets Richard Linklater, the writer, director, and producer of Boyhood. Richard, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, tell me about where the idea for Boyhood came from.
I don't know. I was like, had been a father for a while, and I was thinking about childhood a lot, and anything that's on my mind, I'm trying to kind of maybe make a movie about it. So. But I couldn't really pick a spot, you know, of my own childhood that seemed worthy of an entire film. My ideas were dispersed over all those years. I kind of wanted the big canvas, but you can't really do that in film. A novelist can do that, but in film, you're stuck with the physicality of the actor's age, right? You know, like you got a 7-year-old or, you know, you can't have them jump around in age unless you cast a bunch of different people. I was just stuck, basically. I didn't have the... you know, that moment. But then the idea hit me to, what if you filmed a little bit every year? I could actually express that bigger canvas of maturing and hit a lot of points along the way, not only about growing up, but, you know, parenting, because the movie's very much about these two youngish parents who are still figuring that out. You know, they're a divorced couple, but you see them kind of in their lives figuring that out. So that was the idea. This kind of longitudinal, narrative that could work through these years, and it was always designed to cover first through 12th grade, which feels like that's the thing you're handed, you know, in our society, and then he kind of goes off to college at the end. So that structure was always there.
How did the story evolve and change as the actors grew and changed?
Well, it was kind of the design of the whole movie was to. I knew it would kind of go where they went. I had that year every year to shoot, edit, and then just kind of think for a year and kind of, you know, the movie would change with them. The details would be filled in, not just with how the actors were developing, but, you know, the culture or anything that was striking me as worthy of being in the film. So you get these kind of moments, you know, that maybe whether it's the Obama election or a Harry Potter book release or, you know, little things that I thought, you know, that's something you would remember maybe. I saw the whole film as a kind of a memory, a remembrance, but it was a period film we were shooting in the present tense. It was always thinking way ahead what would resonate, what would matter, and, you know, I mean, the backdrop, you know, technological change and all that I knew that would just be kind of inherent in them. In the design of the movie, you know?
The movie is about these two young parents, divorced, single mother raising two little kids. That is a scenario that a lot of middle class American families are going through, you know, and it becomes more pervasive with every passing year. I wonder, to what extent were you thinking about that, about something that really connects with where the middle class or the white middle class is right now?
Well, it's just not uncommon. I mean, my parents divorced, but that was a long time ago. It was less, you know, it was kind of rare back then. Now it seems like that's the norm for our culture, and not just American culture, worldwide. You know, people point at that and say, oh, it's the values. No, it's a worldwide thing that the family unit is just changing in something else. So, you know, a lot of young people have step siblings or, you know, additional family members. It's kind of this fluid thing, but that's just, it felt very real and worthy of exploring, you know.
Talk to me about the sibling relationship, because I found that to be one of the most affecting things about the movie. So, you know, you grew up in this kind of chaotic family, you know, things are changing, you're being uprooted, going from one place to another. But then you've got one other person in the world who also has the same difficult parents or wonderful parents or whatever else. I mean, what was your thinking about that?
It's pretty fascinating. I was trying to mirror how I felt about I have two older sisters, and...
So do I.
Yeah. And from the younger, it's amazing how much they kind of dominate your life when you're younger. Like, your parents are one thing, but the other kids kind of, like, you're the youngest, you're stuck with them. But, and you do battle. You battle for territory and rights. And but how that changes, especially if you've been through a lot together, you know, you're kind of partners. And at some point, you're supportive of one another. So we see that they kind of, you know, they irritate each other when they're younger, but by the end they're really supportive of what you see them sticking up for each other. So I think that's the best version, I think, of sibling. But you know, there's going to be those conflicts just by nature. You know, that just negotiating space in this world is always kind of difficult, sometimes treacherous with siblings.
One thing I wonder about is you know, the star of the film, young guy called Ellis Coltrane. Just being around you, being around these adult actors,
or Mark or anything on the baseboard there behind the door,
being around the scene, having this be this thing that's a kind of landmark of his life, that must have shaped his personality, because he's starting out when he's 6 years old.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon. It's fascinating, and he speaks very eloquently about it. Like, I always say, yeah, the film was going to go where he went, but the real question, did he go kind of where the film went too? It's a mystery, but he speaks, he has a lot to say about how he felt it did kind of shape his life to be involved in this long-term artistic project that it didn't even feel like a film. It was like he was working with actors like Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette.
It's got to be a pretty heady experience.
Just part of the thing, you know, the set photographer is this cool guy. He's, you know, giving him some, you know, he becomes kind of a photographer. Who knows how
that is
this,
wild.
Any experience shapes any of us. You know, I think it's, but in this case, it's kind of a big responsibility for the film and myself, but I felt that, and I hope that this would be a positive thing in his life. And I think the upside of it was you get all the fun stuff, the creative upside of being involved in something like this, and never the downside of it actually being coming out, you know, the way people respond or are disappointed or, you know, whatever that might be for a child actor, he didn't have to experience. He's 19 now and the film's out, so he can at least process it all as a young adult. But I think it could screw up a 12-year-old, depending on how, you know, how people respond, you know.
So the film starts out in one city, and then the family, in this kind of traumatic way that, you know, that it can be when you're a little kid, moves to another city and then kind of, and bounce around a little bit more. All in Texas, but in very, very different landscapes. And I wonder about that, just, you know, as the boy, as Mason Jr. grows up, how did you treat kind of landscape and kind of his view on the world and how it shaped the film itself?
Well, there was always a certain mobility, and I kind of wanted to capture the powerlessness that you have as a little kid. If your parent gets a new job in a town somewhere far away, then you're just uprooted and you say goodbye to your friends and move. You know, you have no agency over what's really going on in your life. So, that's how I kind of felt. We moved around a lot, but I think a lot of people do, but yeah, we never, Texas is a good state to be stuck in because it's so big. There was a lot of, we never really leave the state border, but it does cover quite a bit of ground. And at the end, he drives all the way to, you know, West Texas. He's going to college out there. Totally different look, you know, you're out in the mountains. It's kind of beautiful.
You have an ensemble. You have actors you've worked with for a really long time, actors that you've seen grow up and change, actors I'm sure you've influenced and perhaps you've been influenced by.
Sure.
In different ways. I wonder, you know, since this is such a long-term project, what is it that the actors playing the parents brought to the film and brought to the changing storyline?
Oh, gosh, so much. I mean, the reason I wanted to work with, like, Ethan and Patricia, they were both, you know, relatively young parents, of Patricia especially. And I thought they would have a lot to say or express about that. I mean, this whole thing's kind of a collaboration of, I mean, everybody was a kid once, and then we all have our own parents in that relationship. And then we all, the three of us, were going through our own parenting, you know, as parents. Between us, I think there were 5 kids born, you know, while we were making.
And your oldest daughter is one of the stars of the film.
So it's very kind of family oriented. Yeah, my oldest daughter is plays the older sister. So. It was just kind of a fun project that was the subject, family. So everyone was, there's probably not anything in the movie that wasn't kind of tethered to someone's reality that either happened or maybe they, you know, it's all pretty real.
Were there any sharp turns? You know, was there ever a situation where, you know, Olivia and Mason Sr. clashed because the actors had kind of different visions of how a kid ought to be raised or anything like that?
No, I think anything like that happened off screen or it happened before the movie starts. They're already separated, you know, they're divorced when it begins. So it's kind of from the kid's perspective. Like, you never know why your parents divorced. They just aren't together anymore. And maybe you learn later. Like, even in the last episode, he hears something from a kind of a drunken uncle who's just going off on his graduation party. But he says something that kind of shines a light back on what his parents' relationship must have been like at that moment. You know, so it's never too late to kind of try to understand, you know, what was going on when you were too little to understand. So kind of a fascinating thought, really. But this 12-year period in this canvas created kind of afforded that sort of thinking.
So Mason Jr. has this arc where, I mean, it's just amazing, you know, in these early scenes, he's just a little delinquent. You know, he's just kind of, you know, running around the subdivision, you know, kind of graffitiing and
spray painting.
Kind of thing. Exactly. I mean, it's pretty advanced for a 6-year-old.
Well, he's got a friend who's, you know, he's probably got the friend who's leading him to that. I don't think any of the stuff, he's not like getting into trouble. He's, property damage, he's not, but you know, you're around it. What kid isn't?
Yeah.
You know, by the time he's in eighth grade, they're having this camp out where there's some beers and, you know, the older guys are really, you know, pushing.
Egging them on.
Yeah, it's like we've all been to that camp out, so.
So there is this little moment though, in the movie where I just feel as though just a light switch, you know, gets turned on. I mean, just this moment where you just suddenly see Mason Jr. as an adult. And I thought this moment happened when he was camping with his dad. There's just this moment where suddenly, like, whoa, where do these words come from? I mean, this kid is so dazzlingly articulate. I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I kind of wanted it to mirror how you do kind of come into your own, you know? Like, you're so influenced and limited, I would say, by this world around you that you find your own space in it. And I thought the film would show that eventually. He would kind of come to the fore in his own narrative. And
Mom.
You start seeing more attitude and opinions.
Have you been partying?
A little bit.
Oh, okay.
You know, and truly, that was Eller and kind of growing into the part where he could, you know, he was more and more of an active participant. He was, even as a little kid, you know, he would, you know, put this in your own words, or we'd talk through scenes. But, you know, as it went on later, I would be with him like, well, what do you think of something? And, you know, oh, let's work up a scene around, you know, he had a theory about the new star, if there were ever going to be another Star Wars movie, which gets a laugh now. But he was talking about it based on one of the video games from it. And I was like, oh, that's something you'd be talking to your dad. They would bond over that because,
yeah.
You know, Ethan's character is obviously, you know, a fan too. He's of that age. So, you know, father-son campfire. Let's talk about Star Wars.
Do you feel like you had a moment like that, a moment where your brain kind of switched on and you became a part of the larger universe?
You mean in my own development? I mean, it's one thing, you have your own thoughts and feelings, but I guess it gets more official the more articulate you become or you can bounce those ideas. I don't know. I don't know if I had one moment, to tell you the truth.
I think I did.
Did you?
When I was 9 years old, 1989, the movie Batman came out starring Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
You know, big, big movie. And there was a cover of Newsweek magazine talking about Batmania. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, I'm experiencing Batmania
you
right
now. You are
Batmania.
They're counting on you to buy a ticket opening weekend. I have a, yeah.
But I was thinking that was like my arrival into the world. Yeah, I'm in the world.
I am here. I'm part of something much bigger than yourself. Batmania.
Like that ever happened to you? Like, well, because one, as a filmmaker, how does a young person decide that movies aren't just an escape, a place you go to on a Sunday afternoon and, you know, buy some M&Ms, but rather a movie's a thing that people make?
Know.
You know, you got a camera, you got a gaffer, you've got a best boy, you've got this guy, you got that guy. Like, how do you figure that out?
It took me a long time. Well, I'm from another era, you know, that people really didn't know anything about it. The curtain now, everybody knows everything, you know, a young, and the technology, you know, you actually can make films. God, I can't explain to you how foreign a land I felt I grew up in East Texas, where we had, it was like the Last Picture Show. We had one theater, one screen, and a new movie would open every Friday. And it was just an entertainment, you know, it was like John Wayne movie, Elvis movie, you know, whatever was going on. It was always fun. But the idea from where I came from that I could ever make a movie, I mean,
well, was the movie theater important to you? Like it was like a place you go to a lot?
Was it? Yeah, it was just fun. But no, it was just entertainment. But I was always a writer, you know, fifth grade on, I felt, oh, I'm a writer. You know, I would write the short story that they would read to the teachers or that, you know, I was always, that was my means of expression young, but I hadn't discovered cinema. That, I came to that more, you know, at age 20, in my early 20s. So now I think it's open to young people so much more readily that you know about, you know, even when I was a kid, I think the only famous filmmaker was Alfred Hitchcock. And even then, I didn't know what he did. He was just that guy who made those movies, you know. He was in them, and there was something cool. But I didn't know what a film director did. I didn't see it as an option. There was a moment, you know, once I was about, you know, I was getting older, and I, you know, started seeing some movies, and like, oh, wow, that's a means of expression. Like, wow, you could maybe write a movie or express yourself in cinematic terms. So it... Once that realization hit me, I just started thinking, and I realized I was thinking already in cinematic terms. I wasn't like a novelist. I was a filmmaker. You know, I had those images in my head, and I could edit in my head. You know, whatever visual thing that is, I think you need to have. I had it. You know?
Well, it's funny you mentioned Hitchcock, because when I think of Hitchcock, I think of this kind of hyper precision, and I think about the way in which, you know, the movie comes fully formed from his brain, and how you know, everything is a kind of a little statue. Every scene is just right.
Storyboarded.
Exactly. Whereas, you know, thinking about Slacker, for example, I mean, this is just, you know, ultra naturalistic and feels like a portrait of this, the, you know, big belly of this living, breathing city.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how much of that is just my imagination, how much of it really is super precise and storyboarded, and how much it was just kind of supernatural.
Most films really are. There is a precision, and I mean, it's all a construct. You know, I'm always going for that realistic feel where you take it as a reality, but, you know, nothing's real. You really have to work to achieve that. So, but Hitchcock, I think, was the extreme. And there are other filmmakers who, you know, it's all planned. You know, it's storyboarded. Here's the shot. The shooting of it is really just the rendering of something that's already been determined. You could be bored on your own set. You know, you're reading. It's just like, okay, we got that. Check. Not that those films can't be great. It's just a personality thing. I'm never so confident, you know, in my scripts the way I see it as this kind of living, breathing thing. I want to collaborate and keep it growing, you know, like an idea. Most of my films, I'm trying to explore something that I'm not even sure what it is. So I'm still learning and feeling my way through a particular subject, sometimes something I have mixed feelings about. So I really enjoy the process of rehearsing and continuing to write and shooting, even up to the shoot, between takes. Maybe there's a new something worth exploring. So to me, it's a living, breathing thing always, you know. So, but that said, it sounds loose, but it's still pretty precise medium.
So it's true that your films feel like they're living and breathing, though you have made some films that do feel, you know, a lot more like a Broadway musical, like a lot more produced. Like School of Rock is definitely a movie that, you know, a lot of our viewers will have watched as kids. And I wonder, is that just an example of you wanting to experiment with lots of different forms?
Well, everything's just a different story. You know, every movie's a different story you're trying to tell, and it kind of needs to be told the appropriate way. You know, so for School of Rock, it's fun to have like the luxury of even a low budget studio budget, so we could kind of make those numbers big at the end and have fun with that. So, yeah, just every movie's different. Every story has its own needs. I still work the same way, though. I'd say I work the same way with actors, rehearse, try to draw stuff out of them. And, you know, to me, it's the same. It's the exact same process every time. It's just a different story you're trying to tell.
How much of that is the culture of being in Austin, being in Texas, rather than, let's say, being in a place like L.A. or New York, you know, that allowed you to feel like you didn't have to kiss up to anyone, you could just kind of do your own thing?
Yeah, there's a good and bad side. I mean, you're pretty far from the official industry, you know, so there's not a support network there. But, you know, you can kind of develop on your own outside the, I guess, expectations of an industry or even, say, narrative or what people think a movie is or isn't. So I've always kind of lived in my own bubble of my own, you know, creation in a certain way that I could, it allows me to think a certain way and kind of try to, I guess the key thing is to think it's still worth it. You know, you work 12 years for no money on something, but you're just trying to tell a story. It's not about, it has no ties to like the industry or commercialism or anything. It's just, you know, if you're lucky enough to get a chance to make a movie, you got to kind of appreciate that opportunity and, you know, try to articulate what, you know, your story and what you've been lucky enough to have a chance to do. So this film, Boyhood, just, it was outside of all of that. You know, it just felt like it wasn't even a film. It was just this living art, you know, long-term living art project of some kind. That, yeah, it's in the cinematic world, but it was something that just had no expectations.
Why did you stop at 18, 19?
You know, everybody goes off to college. My film has now gone off to college.
Yeah.
And that's... That's where I find myself today.
Well, you know, you have in the past, a la Mason Jr.'s conversation about the possibility of new Star Wars films, you have revisited old characters. You know, certainly, you know, the before Sunrise, Sunset, Midnight films. Any possibility that Mason Jr. Will emerge at age 30?
Who knows? It could be sooner. I don't know. It's so fresh. You know, we were filming last October. You know, it hasn't even been a year since we weren't. I haven't even processed that this film's over. So, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. But you never know what you're going to think in the future about how something might, you know, occupy your mind and kind of demand to be, you know, articulated or worthy of exploring. So that's why the before movies, you know, Jesse and Celine, we sort of put them away. And then about 5 or 6 years go by and we're like, you know, damn, they're kind of wanting to say something about where they are in life or a new stage of life. So that's how that's happened twice. But I wouldn't predict it would ever happen again. It just either does or it doesn't.
When you see Patricia Arquette, when you see Ethan Hawke, do you ever talk to them about how the lives of Olivia and Mason Sr. will continue to unfold?
Not really, no.
You probably have better things to talk about.
No, we spent our 12 years talking about them and their lives. I haven't really... I mean, we make jokes about, even Patricia, there's that kind of wrenching scene at the end when he goes off to college.
I was practically on the verge of slitting my wrist.
Yeah, I know, it's a tough one. You know, she's like, but I said, you know, this evening a friend's going to call, she's going to go get a drink, she'll be fine. It's just a moment she's sort of earned through this movie. It's something a mom, very real feeling a mom might have, so, but I think she's earned it. But I don't think it spells doom or anything, you know, it's like, hey, she'll find the upside of an emptiness too.
I also was, part of me was hoping that when Mason Sr. has another child, that you'd just start the process all over again.
Here we go, here we go, yeah.
Kind of like a nested Matryoshka doll kind of thing.
Yeah, it could. I told Eller, you know, he's gonna go to Europe, get on a train. It's only like 4 years. He's 19, so.
Oh,
no,
good God.
I'm not that. I'm not
it's
that.
Like a, it's
I'm
like an inception of Linklater films.
Yeah, I have no interest in that. None. I have so many other stories I'm trying to tell, work on, you know, so who knows.
What are some of the stories you're working on?
Wow, it kind of runs the gamut. I don't know. Big, you know, for every film I get made, I tend to get this backlog of scripts I've been working on or developing, or you know, so I sit here with like 10 things I'm ready, I would like to do, but I'm not so sure which is next. Yeah.
Is the desire to keep making films partly a product of the fact that it's kind of the way you've come to express yourself, or mm-hmm. is there some other compulsion at work, or
yeah, what is it? I don't know, I just lucky, I kind of found my medium. It's just the kind of the filter through, you know, the way you see the world, and I guess I'm really lucky that to have had the chance to do that. You know, so many people strive to do it, you know, and I just came along. It feels really natural to me. It's never been a big struggle. I just, you know, making a film for me is a real natural part of life.
Does it feel natural because literally as you go through life, you have a conversation with, you know, your kids or whoever else, or an old friend? I mean, are you seeing it through a kind of cinematic lens, or are you kind of processing and kind of, you know?
I think so. Even reading everything, I kind of adapt it to a film. I'm sort of stuck in that cinematic mode. You know, I know we're kind of in the age of TV now. You know, everybody's, oh, long form and all this. I'm kind of like, God, I'm kind of a feature film guy. And not that I do have some longer things that maybe could be a longer film, and that would be the way to see them, but it's like there are all these expanding possibilities right now in the media landscape, and but I'm feeling a little slow to adapt to that. You know, I just kind of like, I think in feature film terms, I think.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, really good, really nice talking to you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.